We had a couple of people who, at the very last minute, when I say last minute, I mean I asked like 30 seconds ago if they would come up. Like, that's about as last minute as you could get with this kind of thing. So I am very grateful to have our four panelists up here. We have one question for them, and that is, what does Hakusti'i mean to you? So for those of you who have no idea what Hakusti'i means, in Tlingit, when you roughly translate it, it means our way of life and our way of being. So we as Tlingit, you know, the thought process was, everybody else, their version of Hakusti'i is going to be different than mine, or Dion's is going to be different than her mom's. Or, you know, that was the thought process with the question. And, you know, it's kind of open-ended. So, Yedi Kuka, what does Hakusti'i mean to you?
So due to some weather concerns, I am one of the people who was asked just a little more than 30 seconds ago, but not much more than 30 seconds ago. And so it is a really, really big question. And I think that for me, when I'm looking at Hakusti'i, it really is all encompassing. And one of my biggest concerns, just as someone who has been learning about Hakusti'i for my whole life through the Sitka Native Education Program and then through involvement in the dance group that my mom and late grandmother started, the Sheet Kakwan Dancers, as well as doing, I think, like four or five different stints as the dance show coordinator for the Nakahiti Dancers, a lot of my life has been sort of cultural education, but on the side. And what I mean by that is just that I taught at Mount Edgecombe High School for 23 years and 2 years before that in the Bristol Bay region. And so cultural education, trying to share the things that I was really blessed to be able to learn from the elders and the instructors at the Sitka Native Education Program had very much been kind of a side gig. For lack of a better way of putting it. And I retired from Mount Edgecombe High School about a year and a half ago to move into a full-time Indigenous Studies position at Outer Coast, where I now teach Indigenous Studies. And it has enabled me to spend more time involved in cultural education, both in the place-based education that we have and that we offer at Outer Coast, as well as spending more time in the community with cultural education and not having to choose between, you know, those things and whether, you know, I want to have a career, which is what I often had to do at Mount Edgecombe. But one of my biggest concerns about Hakusti'i is that when we look at the history of cultural assimilation through not only residential schools that we've been reading about, when we look at, you know, all of the different articles that have come out and all of the different studies that have come out ever since more bodies were discovered at the Canadian residential schools, but just the educational institutions in general, they didn't have to be residential schools, and especially in Alaska. In Alaska, all of that was brought into our own home villages. Kids didn't have to necessarily get removed from their villages and sent somewhere else for those same kinds of things to happen. Our ancestors were forced away from our language and they were forced away from our culture. And so Hakusti'i was very much endangered, and it still is. And by that, I'm not referring to the same kinds of things that happened to our ancestors, But because of the things that happened to our ancestors, there were generations that weren't blessed to be able to learn about Hakosti, about our language and our culture, and our songs and our dances and our stories and our traditions. And so now we don't have those same kinds of prohibitions. We don't have people who are telling us that we can't do it. But what's happening is you have these generations of people who were effectively kind of the lost generations. And some of them were able to learn very, very little. Some are the children of people who were punished, or the grandchildren of people who were punished. And so those parents and those grandparents and those great-grandparents didn't teach those kids either the things that they knew. And now we have these generations that missed out, but then because they are Tlingit, or fill in the blank with whatever kind of indigenous tribe they come from, they feel this guilt and shame for not already knowing things. And so then they don't feel like they can enter the indigenous spaces to become a part of those things. And so it becomes this sort of vicious cycle where people don't feel like they're worthy of entering the indigenous spaces because they don't feel like they should know that they know the things they should know as Tlingit or as Yupik or Inupiaq, or, you know, like I said, fill in that blank. And so this is something very real that we're battling, because the things that we have are open. The events that we have, the classes that we have, there are more classes, I think, being offered in different aspects of Hakosti, but mostly, I think, the arts than ever. I mean, you cannot open Facebook without seeing that there is a weaving class, another weaving class, a Northwest Coast art class, a moccasin making class, a vest making class, and that's phenomenal. That's wonderful. But we really are looking at something so, so big that trying to figure out what those entry points are going to be and then trying to move forward from there is just a really daunting task. My hope in looking at all of these classes that are being offered, including language classes, many of which are being offered by the university for free if they're not for credit, people are stepping in and taking advantage of those. But when you look at a census, and there are allegedly around 10,000 of us who identify as Tlingit in the census, you know, there are not 10,000 of us learning Hakosti. There are some people who are learning parts of it. And then there are some people who, again, they feel so far removed from it that they don't feel like they can enter those spaces. And so hopefully those spaces where those kinds of classes are being offered in such wonderful numbers in so many communities won't be the end-all be-all, but that they'll be sort of the taking off point where once people start to learn more about our traditional arts, that they feel safer going and learning more about language, learning more about dance, learning more about ceremony, which is the heart of everything that is in our culture. When I'm asked to do presentations for different organizations who want cultural competency trainings, lately my strategy has been to do it through teaching about Tlingit ceremony, because within ceremony contains Hakosti. So you can explain all about the social structure and how things work and what our traditional beliefs are with that as a sort of a taking off point. And so it is a really daunting question, but not only is it a really big overarching question, but looking at how it is that we're going to make sure that Hakosti continues to exist, you know, until the end of time is an even bigger question. It's something that takes, you know, it takes everyone. It takes all kinds of people who have the knowledge in the different areas and are willing to share it to continue working on that. But in the meantime, I think just trying to be the kind of indigenous people who do welcome all kinds of people into those indigenous spaces, so that everybody who wants to learn is able to learn, so that we can continue to have Hakosti for our great, 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 great grandchildren. Gunalchish.
Hello, my name is Gabrielle Raven Hammock. I did the logo for this year's celebration. I was also just told not too long ago about this, so bear with me. I'm a 17-year-old artist from Des Moines, Washington, so bigger city than this cute island. I was born and raised there, so I didn't really grow up with this type of community and with the culture around me. So it was only recently that I was invited here for the first time a couple months ago for Sciatica's 50th celebration, where I also did their logo. And I think that's where I really felt the real weight of our community, and just seeing how friendly everyone is, and it felt like family immediately, and I think that's what it means to me. To go from not knowing much about my culture and to just being welcomed with open arms, I think that's what it truly means to be native. But yeah, I don't think I would have learned much more about my culture if it wasn't for these types of events and being invited to these things. I don't have a super beautiful story like some of these other people do. but I did want to come up here and offer a different perspective on things. Growing up, I knew that I was Native and I knew what clan I came from, but I was never just engulfed in much. I knew where my middle name came from, the story of the Raven and the Sun. But over these last two visits to Sitka, I think that's where I really learned more about my culture than anything else. And I hope other people get the chance to do this like I did. I think it really opens people's eyes to see exactly where they came from. So thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate everyone and everyone's support. Thank you.
I found out this morning, so I've had a little time to think that it was a possibility. Welcome home. I'm glad you're here, and you do belong here, and I hope you continue to come back and continue to learn. You know, I was born and raised here. I'm Kiksedi, and my family's been here since time immemorial, and I didn't grow up. I was one of those people that was in between. It's like my father spoke fluent Tlingit, my mother did not, so we didn't grow up hearing the language. And because of the way the protocols are within the Tlingit culture, both my parents were not only Raven, but they were also both Kiksedi. And so my father was ostracized for years, because in 1950, when they married, that was like the equivalent of, yeah, marrying your brother or your sister. And even, you know, I think that, and I grew up, you know, at Sitka High, hearing from people, oh, why don't you go back to where you came from? And when the land claims were passed in the 70s, there were some of my non-Native friends. It's like, well, my family's been here for two generations. Why aren't we getting paid? And you know what? I didn't have an answer, because our history is not taught. And I did not know how much my ancestors fought for this place. I didn't know about the Battle of 1802 and the Battle of 1804. And the lives that were lost and sacrificed so I could be here today as Tlingit, to know my name, Ashichtla, to know that I'm Kiksedi, to know that I'm Raven, to know that I'm related to the Kagwantan. And so, you know, I think it was fairly easy to, you know, what they call, to internalize what I was hearing. And if you know anything, if you've been around for a while, you know that, you know, for many, many decades, the only thing that we really heard about were all the bad things that were happening in our communities. The alcoholism, the addiction, the domestic violence. And I really believe that, you know, we came to be defined not by the good, not as a thinking person that's been here for centuries, but someone whose life I was destined to suffer because of the color of my skin and because of the birthright I was told that I had. And it's only through people like my mother, like my father, like Esther Littlefield, because as I started getting older, I wanted to, older, I was like 21, 22. And I took a beading class from Esther Littlefield, and I told her, I really want to learn the culture. And I had really hoped that she would sit down and talk with me for hours on end to tell me about what our history was. The one thing I remember that she said, she didn't say a lot, but she said, everything in our culture is about respect. It's about respect for everything in the environment. It's about respect for everything around you. It includes even the rocks that you walk on. You have to have respect for them. You have to have respect for the trees. You have to have respect. And, you know, that was it. And I spent a lot of years not knowing who I was other than, you know, somebody who was identified at a very early age, who didn't fit in, who was nothing but trouble, who was never going to amount to anything, who was an alcoholic, an addict, basically no good, until somebody came along and told me that I was. And I feel like I have spent and continue to spend currently the last 40 years understanding that being a Tlingit woman is not defined by the bad, but it's defined by the good. It's defined by my ancestors who fought. It's defined by my mother who started a program called the Sitka Native Education Program 50 years ago. And it's defined by the people who started teaching the language and the songs and the dances, even though they could have gotten in big trouble from the other clans. And that's the reason we have so many of these songs and these dances. And that's the reason, you know, we have to remember that we have a living culture. And when we have a living culture, that's such a blessing, because that means, yeah, I hear, you know, sometimes I hear women didn't drum and women didn't speak. But you know what? Women also didn't vote. So you know what, I tell people, it's like, if we have a culture, if we have traditions that are hurting people, let's make new traditions. And I am so proud and so happy to be part of a living culture where, yes, I got to take a weaving class last week, and I'm weaving my first raven's tail headband, and that I got to take a raven's tail weaving class with Cheryl, who revived raven's tail weaving after 200 years, and when I sat down to do it, that was Hakusti. I could feel it in my blood. I could tell that I had somewhere an ancestor that was a weaver, because my hands, my fingers knew exactly what to do. And you know, when Dionne started learning when she was 3 years old, we didn't have the Sitka Native Education Program, and the first time I heard her drum, I still remember the moment, the first time I saw her, she was practicing on one of the ferries, and she was drumming and singing, and I started crying. I started crying because I felt like, you know, I had missed out on so much, and I was so proud of her and so proud of the young people. And it's so good to see young people here. It's good to see all of you here. Because I really hope that, you know, Hakusti, to me, it's, I'm on this journey. I'm on this journey. I have been on a journey to understand what it means to be a part of a community and how that community should be, and to find that part of me that is sacred that I lost through all of the racism and the colonization and the denial of my culture and the denial of my identity. And I know that, you know, until I do that, that I can't see that in others. And I think, you know, that's my biggest hope, is that all of you can find that piece of you that understands how sacred life is and how sacred we all are, and to build those relationships that only honor that in each other. Because these are really tough times. These are really, you know, insane times. And, you know, it's been hard. My family's had a lot of losses, but also to watch, you know, the continued genocide and colonization. And I'm so grateful that I have a place to go. I go out to the fort site and I visit with the ancestors a lot and thank them for their sacrifices and thank them for their strength. Because hopefully, I would hope the work that we're all doing to make this a better community. I know for me it gets really hard sometimes. But I don't hope I never take that option to just cut out, just to stop trying. Because I think about, you know, I have great-grandchildren now. And, you know, when I started on my own journey, I thought, you know, I was going to heal myself and I wanted to help my friends. And, you know, a lot of them have passed. So many of them have passed. And then it was for my children. And I've seen changes. This is a change to have a good change to have a room full of people. And then I started thinking about my grandchildren. And the longer I'm around, the more I understand that need for us to be able to make, for me to be able to make decisions today that will affect my grand, great, great grandchildren that I don't even know, so that, you know, they can sit up here or they can go wherever they want and do whatever they want to and not feel like they are held back, and really understand that Hakusti, our way of life, does matter, and that we get to that by understanding who we are and our true history as Tlingit people. Gunavchish.
Thank you. My name's Tommy Joseph. I'm Tlingit Kagwantan from Ketchikan originally. I come to Sitka about 40 years ago. My journey in my culture and learning my culture was through the arts. First opportunity at the age of 8 in Ketchikan, third grade, a one-off situation. Teachers in my school, all non-native teachers in the school, but they brought in, it was a brand new school. Brand new school they built in the valley, and brought in a local wood carver, and a small group of us got to sit with him and make one of what he was making. Was a halibut hook. Tomorrow evening, I have a class at the university. We're currently making halibut hooks. That was 8 years. I mean, I was 8 years old when I did that. So that's 50. 52 years, a long time ago. And anyways, my culture. I grew up in a non-traditional Tlingit family, meaning there were no Tlingits in the house besides my siblings and myself. My mom, non-native from Baltimore. Coast Guard family is what brought, I mean, the Coast Guard is what brought my mom's family to Alaska, and actually all over the country. But they settled in Alaska for a little while. Then when my mom was in high school, she met my dad, full Tlingit from Kloak on Prince of Wales Island. When the rest of the family moved, my mom stayed, and they started a family with my dad and my mom, and I have four siblings. I mean, sorry, four sisters and a brother. So I grew up in a house where after my dad was a fisherman. I think I was destined to be a fisherman until that moment when I was 8 years old, he was lost at sea. Actually, I'm sorry, I was 5 years old when he was lost at sea. So I grew up with a non-traditional Tlingit family because there were no Tlingits in the house other than my siblings and myself until my grandmother moved in from California, my mom's mom. My grandmother's house, my dad's side, was just a short ways away. Literally, there's a building in front of my house. If that building wasn't there, I could see kitty corner through to the next neighborhood and see my grandmother's house. She was full Tlingit from Kloak, Tuxacan, the village before that. So when we go visit with grandma, that's when we became Tlingit. That's when we learned about our Tlingit, who we were at the background. And then the rest of our time, we're on the other block where we were back to being us. I mean, we were always us, but I mean, we were, the influences weren't there of the native culture, but I found my way through the arts because anywhere there was somebody doing kind of carving or showing painting, or there was outdoor exhibition of something, which in those days there weren't too many. But I always found myself hovering over those kind of things. And so every opportunity there was, they came up with the culture, the native, I mean, the arts, I was there. Teenager, I worked at a museum in Ketchikan, and it was a museum / tourism. It was a brand new facility that they built for, they housed the largest collection of original totem poles in Southeast Alaska. And I got to be a tour guide and talk about our culture and learn about our culture and share all that stuff. And then when I wasn't being a tour guide, I was sitting in another room behind, that was all glass walls, and tourists got to come by and watch me and occasionally ask me questions, and I was carving for them. I was a teen, so I kind of grew up being a demonstrating artist, which I do a lot here in Sitka. I have done most of my career here in Sitka as a demonstrating artist for the culture center that used to be here. I don't know. Arts, I found my way through the arts, and I'm still finding my way through the arts. So growing up, I had my first 13 years of growing up in Ketchikan. The last 40 years of growing up, been here in Sitka. I've done a lot of growing here. Thank you. Normally, I don't have a speech or talk to people like this. Normally, it's people come to me and ask me questions, and I share whatever that way. So this is really new to me to stand up in front of people like this. So anyways, passing the mic.
So I'm not sure any of you guys heard that. Luis said, Alex, are you going to sing us a song? So had to crack a joke real quick. My Uncle Herman, Teotu Ish, he was one of the panelists. Anytime he has the microphone, he always starts singing, If I Were a Rich Man, doobie-doobie-doobie-doo. Every time, so I had to sing it real quick just for Luis. Yeah. So we still have some time before the next events are happening, so if anybody from the audience has some questions that they'd like to ask our folks, now would be a perfect time. Just stand up, we got a mic right here.
I just want to celebrate some of the things that were said about welcoming everyone so the language doesn't die. and at Hoots Elementary School. I know a 7-year-old, a first grader, who says he only likes recess and Clinket. And he has long blonde hair, and I just am so grateful that he has that opportunity, because our traditional schooling academics isn't for everybody. So I am so thankful for that grant and so thankful for his teacher that he can have something he likes about school. He did ask me the first, I think it was close to the first day. I see him about once a week, and he said, "Do you know Clinket?" And I said, "Well, I know Hoots." And I know he's Sean. And he said, "Well, I hadn't heard that one yet." And then I sang Siguyu, happy birthday, Siguyu Yagi. I sang that to him, and he said, yes, he had heard that. And I am sure in a little time he will have that down, but the confidence that it's giving kids. And I talked to his teacher, and she said, the Clinket teacher, and she said that she's heard from a lot of kids saying that they really enjoy Clinket class. And I know that that school does not have a music teacher this year because of cuts, and they sing regularly in Clinket. So that's another gift that the class is giving.
My hat's off to you folks up there speaking for your culture. I grew up learning about the culture when I was in school, but I really didn't know a lot about it. My name is Brian. I've always been really impressed with the Raven story, how he steals the sunlight. But I have a question for Louise, I believe. Do you know if they're going to have Reconciliation Day this year around Alaska Day?
Maybe. Dion and I did the first one at the sesquicentennial. So when was that? 2017? You can't math?
I can't math.
Can anybody else math?
2017. Yeah, 2017.
So that was 7 years ago. And I have been thinking about that. I would like to. But I think it's time that we add an opportunity for our allies as well to support us in the work. So if anybody here would like to say something about the importance of recognizing true history, that would be awesome. Because it is, sometimes we don't know how people are going to take it, and I love that people are coming. So thank you for that question. I feel like we have felt supported. But yeah, I would love to hear from some of our allies as well. And I'm not sure where we'll have it, because it might rain, but we'll figure it out.
No.
So both Mom and I are going to be out of town for Reconciliation Day.
Oh,
you're not? You canceled your trip?
Yes, I am. No.
You are going to be here now? Okay, so Louise will be doing Reconciliation Day. Just kidding. Okay. I will be out of town, but, we were also, when she was going to be out of town originally, we were talking about it, and one of the things that I think is really important, if we're looking at Hakwasti, back to the sort of the overall topic of the panel, a lot of that is also just looking at, the impacts of historical trauma and generational trauma. And, not everybody does see Alaska Day as Reconciliation Day. A lot of people, they just say, why don't you just get over it? It's in the past. And I think, looking at the place of Alaska Day in, where we're at as far as trying to preserve Hakus tea and as much of it as we can is really important. But one of the other things is, I mean, you know, not everybody is going to like Mom and I. Not everyone's going to like someone who is political in different ways. But the thing is, you know, we don't, you know, ask to be up in front, like things like, you know, today happened because there were weather delays. But one of the things that we'd really like to see happen is for some of our younger people among us to be picking up the reins and taking, you know, taking some of the responsibility to make these things happen. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, in the future, whether or not Mom and I are in town, there are Kiksuddy who are not us. There are a lot of them. And, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Kiksuddy just because of our history in this place. It typically has been, and it is appropriate for that. But you know, we really do need to look to a lot of our younger people to start picking up those reins and taking care of these things and making sure that those folks who are around and want to continue to look at history through that lens are able to do so, you know, whether or not we're in town. And so it takes a village, and that's something that we also really need folks to do. And that being said, like we do have allies who have stood with us, you know, at the various reconciliation days that we've had since 2017. But it would just be really phenomenal to see more of our young people step up and say, you know, you're not going to be here this year. I'd still really like to make this happen. And both of us would work with anyone who would want to take the reins on things like Reconciliation Day. And so just looking to get younger folks really mindful of their place in Sheetka and their place in preserving Hakus tea is, you know, really the next gigantic step that we need to be looking at, because, you know, we're not going to be here forever, and so we need folks who can organize and advertise and move and shake and make things happen. Ganachish.
My name's Eric Jordan, and I grew up in the neighborhood with Louise and Dion, and I worked with Bill Brady at Search in the recovery program as a therapist. I just want to say what you just said, Dion, is so true. The trauma those of us who work in the field see, and the grief and the anger, it's so sad for all of us. And as the son of an immigrant, what's going on in this country right now, who my first wife was an immigrant from Korea, we've got to do better. And panels like this and people like you stepping forward really makes a difference. And what you just said, I'm 75 and I'm passing the torch to younger people in my political activism. It's so important to not just pass the torch, but to step aside so other people can take it up. And that's why your words resonate so strongly with me, Dion, and the rest of you, Louise, Tommy. Thank you so much.
I am not from here. I'm visiting here from Denmark. And it's a huge pleasure for me to be here, to watch your culture, to feel your culture, and this July I went to Brazil to visit the Huni Queen Indians in the Amazon, And they have been struggling for the last 20 years to keep their culture, their traditions, their ceremonies. And this struggle, I recognize it here. And there's one thing I was wondering when I visited them and when I visit you now, is besides from keeping up and preserving your culture, how and what can you learn us that is not a part of your culture? What do you think we need to learn from you?
Thank you.
Yeah, good excuse for the question. You know, I mean, there's just so many things. And I think, you know, one of the things I really would encourage people to do is to, you know, really understand what an ally is. And then I think because it's a challenge, it's getting harder and harder for me to live here. You know, financially, emotionally, spiritually, just because of all the changes, the gentrification, and, you know, I think part of it is showing up. I mean, really, it's showing up to these places. I worked for the tribe a while ago. And, you know, we were planning a meeting with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and between our cultural committee and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And so the staff from Alaska Department of Fish and Game immediately wanted to send us an agenda. I said, no. We know what your agenda is. We know what you want to do. We would like you to come and listen to us. And I think that, you know, even though there are so many challenges, that we have been really, really, really resilient, all of us. You know, any of you Indigenous people sitting here right now, we are amazingly, amazingly resilient. To have had so many different things, so many different policies, termination policies of all the different governments trying to get rid of who we are. But we're still here. We're still strong. And I would encourage you to, you know, reach out to the different organizations to see how you can help. You know, I was just, you know, people are struggling. It's great that classes are being taught at the University of Alaska Southeast. Call your representatives, call people, say, you know, it needs to be in the colleges, it needs to be in the schools, the history needs to be taught in the schools. You know, it's like, really the tribe is thriving, but it's thriving on grants, it's thriving on soft money. You know, we don't have a land base, we don't have reservations, we are not allowed to tax. So, you know, the whole thing is dependent sovereign nations. Can you imagine trying to run the city without taxes? We have a lot of struggles, and I think I'm gonna put in a pitch. I've been traveling, I've been down to Peru, and I went down to Mexico, and I'm hoping to go down to Australia, because one of the things we're finding is that I work with Native movement, and we just had a gathering called Ceremony as Resistance. And ceremony to me is the ideal of what we're looking for, how we want our communities to be. And we're hoping, a friend of mine had submitted a grant to bring some people up that I had met in Mexico. And they're from Colombia and Ecuador and Central America, Guatemala, Mexico. We didn't get the grant. So I could be, if any of you are great grant writers or fundraisers, we want to bring about 10 people, 10 to 15 people up, because I was fortunate to sit in ceremony with them this spring. So, you know, there's a lot of things. Show up to places. And, you know, I tell people, like the Sitka School District, we always used to get this feedback that, oh, well, you know, Native parents don't really care because they don't show up to the what do you call it, parent-teacher conferences. I said, you know, why don't you have a meeting at the A and B hall and see how many people show up? Because there's a lot of places still that, you know, because of the way that things are structured, that I don't feel comfortable going. When my son
was in the school district, I did not feel comfortable going to any of the schools. So even if you're uncomfortable, you know, reach out. It's like comfort is a privilege. So I would encourage you to go places that are maybe not comfortable for you. Gracias.
Hello, my name is John Young. I'm originally from Huna. I'm the speaker of our clan house. This is my father's country. I'm glad to be staying here because of the things that I learned here. One of the things that I learned here while I've been traveling the back roads in the woods is the animals that want to tell us stories. I have so many stories, I could sit here for an hour and talk to you about what the animal people are telling me and showing me and the things that I want to know from them, they teach me. I've been sober 35 years, and these are the things I learned in my father's country, that the animals are out here. They don't just fly around, and they know us. They've known us all our life, and our stories, if we pay attention to them, they'll come to your house and talk to you. It's the first things you hear in your head. I've talked to the smallest little bird when I found that their baby died. And what they did after I gave their baby back to them is they knew where I lived, came to my front door when the sun came up and sang me a morning song to know that I was the one that brought their little baby back to the woods. So when I pay attention, walk around, look up, and pay attention to the birds and the animals that are around me, they're telling a story to you. They want you to pay attention. And when I was paying attention, they told me so many stories and how the Raven and Eagle clans protect one another. You would think that the mothers and fathers of the Eagle Clan would be the one protecting them. But I found out, and I took pictures of it, have a video of it, where the ravens were the ones doing the security for the young eagles that are out there taking their first bath. And they told me, the Raven Clan showed me, and I talked to Uncle Herman and told him the story that they told me, and how they acknowledge when one of theirs passes away, how they do it, and how they show others. If you pay attention, they are out there. And if your first things in your head is what they're wanting to talk to you about. It's amazing. I could sit here, I've been trying to figure out how to get in front of you guys and tell you the stories they've been telling me. It's amazing when they know you. They know all of us. They've known us since we were kids playing around out here. I grew up in the Raven House. My father was a house sitter. So I know they've known me all my life. And to be in my father's country and to hear and listen to these stories, and I know that some of you guys don't believe, but Bigfoot helped me out one day when I was out there in the woods, walking around. He was watching me, or she was watching me, and helped me. I gave a jewelry container out of the most beautiful tree I ever seen in my life, and I had plans. And I was gonna go up there and saw the branches off, bring it home, and make jewelry containers out of it. Never said a thing in my out like I'm talking to you. It was in my mind and my heart, and Bigfoot helped me out by pulling those branches out of the tree, stacking them there for me, and waiting for me to get there the next day. So I'm trying to figure out how and how many people are in our clan houses or in our cities that know stories that can be sitting in front of you guys and telling you how the animal people are paying attention to us. Because they know us. They've known us all our life. And sometimes when you hear me out in the hallway, that's as close as I got to until now, that I can tell you that I got a lot of stories. And a lot of it is on camera, pictures I took, evidence of how they interact with me. So if we pay attention, and if we listen to all these stories they want to tell us, then we'll be sitting here when slack time is going around and people want to figure out what to say. We could hear people talking about their interactions with all the animal people that are out there. Because you got to pay attention. You got to have a good heart. You got to want to be able to tell stories to everybody. And they'll come and teach you. Goodness, jeez.
Are there any questions for the panelists? Hi, my name is Jackie. I just have a quick question. I read in the news that fewer people are moving from the rest of the United States to Alaska, and demographers are predicting a population drop due to this. But I'm wondering, do you see this as a win for the native people of Alaska? Oh, the question, I mean, sorry, to rephrase this is, do you see the fact that, you know, fewer people, you know, presumably not, most of them are not native, moving from the rest of the United States to Alaska, do you think that could be a win for the native people of Alaska?
My mom and I are going to Indian leg wrestle right up here. I don't know that fewer people moving into Alaska really matters. I think what matters is who's already here and what they do when they're here, as far as non-Native people who've already made their way to Alaska. I think one of the hardest things about, you know, that sort of influx over the last 150 years or so, is that a lot of the people who made their way to Alaska did so during different rushes. And so their whole aim was to exploit and to extract. And a lot of those folks, you know, aren't probably still with us, but, you know, their descendants might be. And so I think what really matters more than the amount of people or number of people making their way into Alaska is just what the folks who are already here are doing, what they're willing to learn, how they're willing to live with us. Because, you know, we have a lot of things left that we're working on as Indigenous people. And like I said, we don't have necessarily the same kind of punishments for culture or language in the schools that our ancestors did. But trying to find ways to actually bring those things into the schools is still an ongoing struggle. When we're looking at renaming, you know, Hoots Elementary, there was a whole bunch of pushback about taking Baranoff's name off of it. And Baranoff, Alexander Baranoff, if he could have, you know, extinguished our people, he would have. And people just didn't get that it was the ultimate insult to have his name on a school that we sent our children to. And if you could see the comments in the different threads on Facebook, you got to see who we live with. you got to see the people whose children and grandchildren that our children and grandchildren have to live with, the things that they said and how they said it. When we're looking at renaming the school, you know, the original ask of the school board was to rename it after a cultural educator. And there were a whole bunch of controversies within our own Native community about that and a whole bunch of fighting, when really what the school board was trying to do was they weren't trying to insult anyone. They were trying to put back some of what had been taken by, you know, re-entering that goodwill. Because they could have just said, we want to rename it. We'll rename it Sitka Elementary School. But a lot of the comments that came out of that were things like, okay, if we're going to name it something Tlingit, it needs to be something that's easy for everybody to say. Nobody cared how easy English was for our ancestors. Nobody cared. And so, you know, realizing that, you know, there's so much Eurocentrism left and that's what we're dealing with, and having strong allies in those chat threads, having strong allies in those meetings, you know, people said, well, what's going to be next? Renaming the island? No, you renamed the island. It had a name. It was She. You renamed it. We're not the ones who are rewriting history. You are. And we need allies when those conversations happen, when those comments happen. We need people who are in those rooms when, you know, we start asking to have our place names placed on maps, when we ask to have our place names placed on the signs that are around town. You know, we finally got Wetlacheqehin up there where it said No Name Creek for how long? It was not a no-name creek. It had a name. It was just disregarded. And so I think it doesn't matter how many people continue to come in or out. What matters is what the people who are here with us will do with us. So I think, you know, folks coming, showing up for Indigenous Peoples Day and the large numbers that we've seen for the last several years, you know, it's a great start, but it's a question of us not just doing this, you know, on the second Monday in October every year, but having it be something where people stand with us year round. Ganachish.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name's Harriet Villasado Marino Belial, and I first came to Sitka when I was 14 years old to go to Mount Edgecombe. But when Dion was talking about renaming the school, I was very active in front of the assembly, because I figured, in my estimation, you know, I wanted it named after Isabel Brady and Charlie Joseph, because they did so much with the language and passing it on to the next generations, which I didn't learn because my grandmother wasn't teaching us, because she was told that, you know, it wasn't going to be necessary in the next, we had to adjust to the Western civilization and all that stuff. But, and I really felt like, I knew that up in Anchorage, they named the schools after William Tyson, one of the leaders from the Yupik Nation, right next door to where my daughter lives, the William Tyson Elementary. But, you know, you say that we're the first people of this land, and yes, that is true. But the thing is they have to respect that we are, and they have to listen. When we get up, you know, I'm 90 years old now. I got up and I said what I felt, which was that they should have named that Baranoff School after our leaders. And I just wanted to say that to everybody here, because the language, I can't speak it, my children can't speak it, and my grandchildren, because we didn't learn. And my grandmother was told, no, it wasn't necessary. But it is necessary, and so, you know, we owe a lot to the ones that did pick it up, Charlie Joseph and Isabel, and they went ahead with teaching it, and I'd like to say that publicly. Thank you very much, because that we are the people of this land. The other thing I wanted to ask was, I wanted to ask Tommy, I grew up between Block and Wrangell, and I'd go back and forth as a child on the mail boats with my sister. But I knew all the Kluwak people too, and everybody. And I know that Tommy's grandparents come from there, and I met William and his wife. And I was just wondering, Tommy, I was thinking to myself, did you learn your totem pole carving through your grandparents? Or, and you know, you shared a little of your story with us today. And there isn't very many that have learned like you have. So I thank you very much, you know, with all the contributions and the contributions of Louise's family and all the families. We need it. And you know, nobody has to tell us what to say or what to think. We know what to think, and we know who we are. And I always feel bad that I didn't learn my language, but that's not my fault, but I listened to them. So Tommy, I wanted to ask you, did you learn your totem pole carving skills from your grandparents, or how did you pick it up? Thank you.
So really quick before we move forward, Tommy's gonna be the last speaker. It's almost 7 o'clock, and I wanna respect all the people who are leading the breakout sessions.
So no, my grandparents, my dad, my dad's dad, I don't know if he ever carved or not. I asked my Uncle William, who was just here yesterday or the day before from Kluwak. I asked him a couple years ago down visiting him if he had ever carved, and my uncle said that he tried it once. He was working with Nathan Jackson when they were young men in Ketchikan at the old A&B Hall on Dermont, and he said he tried it once. He cut himself, so he only tried it once. He didn't try it again. But then I asked if my grandfather had carved, his dad, and he said he didn't know. He said that his dad had a trunk full of old carving tools, but they were just his carving tools. He never saw him carve or use them. So no, I never knew my grandfather. He was gone before I was born. And totem pole carving, I actually learned to do that right here in Sitka. I mean, I've been around it my whole life. Ketchikan has, I think, the largest amount of totem poles in all of Southeast, and they had the largest collection of original totem poles there. Just growing up and having been around them, and it was just the next step. One day somebody asked me if I can carve them a totem pole, and I said yes, and I carved them a totem pole. That was my very first totem pole. I learned to do it by doing it, hands-on doing it, and just applying whatever I had learned and seen around me.